And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour Top 10 with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now Intercontinental LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Well, hello there, Dean Haglund.
Hello, Phil Lernis. How are you?
I'm good. We are rapidly winding down year 10 of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. And this...
How fast was that?
...is the ninth top 10 show we have done in this year 10.
Ah, I see what you're doing.
Oh, you finally caught on.
I did. I didn't know why we were doing all this.
Yeah. So week after next, a fortnight, a mere fortnight from now, we will wrap up year 10 of this podcast with our top 10 most memorable episodes of Chilpack Hollywood Hour. And that will be fun, and I bet it will surprise each of us what our, you know, what we recollect.
Yes.
Because these are not, these will not be our necessarily the episodes that we say are the best, but they're for whatever reason made them personally memorable for us.
Yeah, it stuck out, and we both jogged each other's memories.
And,
I'm sure.
And with that show, today's show is not necessarily a celebration of the best. When we say most overlooked science fiction films, it's possible that some of these films are bad. I have one on here that I know is not good. But but still, it might be a real head-scratcher as to why it's overlooked, because let's face it... sometimes the most famous films are the very bad films, and being bad,
or that they require second viewing. That says they're not necessarily bad,
right?
Just they were in the context of the time, nobody liked them,
right? Or quite to the contrary, right? Sometimes bad films are well liked, are big box office hits. I'm looking at you.
That's true.
Fate of the Furious. So. maybe we could start. I don't know if you have any that you thought about but didn't include. I have a couple that I wish more people would watch, but I couldn't in good conscience include them because they didn't quite fit the definition, and I thought that might be a great way of also describing what we are looking for.
Well, this is a great question that I thought we'd bring up, because what is overlooked? I mean... movies I've seen 6 or 7 times that I love and that maybe no one else has seen, a la Phantom of the Paradise. Is that an overlooked movie, or is that just a movie that everyone thinks is weird and I love? So
right. Overlooked and underrated are not the same thing.
Right.
Right. Underrated
Absolutely.
Means people know about it. And they just don't give it its due. But overlooked is, why don't more people know about this?
Right. That's the thing.
See, so, I have on here one that I thought about including, but did not, which was 1978's Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Oh, yeah, right.
Directed by Philip Kaufman, starring Donald Sutherland, Brooke Adams, Veronica Cartwright from SciFest, Jeff Goldblum, and in a great supporting role, Leonard Nimoy. And it was a remake, of course, of the 1956 Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And if I may, it's one of the 10 greatest film remakes of all time, maybe even one of the top 5 remakes of all time. It is, I think, in and of itself a masterpiece. And by the way, that could be a future top 10 show sometime. Top 10 really good remakes, because there have been some. So
absolutely.
Maybe we do that. But the point is that it's not really overlooked. It was a hit at that time, and people know about it. people know right. of all the invasion movies and the body snatchers and the remakes. And so it might fit more an underrated because of the attitude people so often have about remakes. Right.
Right.
But it's, yeah, but it's not overlooked. And the other that I had on here, which I do think is sadly overlooked, it's becoming more and more overlooked as the years go on and there's less and less education in terms of cinema and critical thought and critical analysis. But it's a 1962 French science fiction featurette by Chris Marker that at one time was responsible for more of a particular generation of film students being inspired to go into filmmaking than any other movie.
Right.
And it's La Jetée, and it's constructed yeah. almost entirely from still photos, tells the story of a post-nuclear war time travel experiment. It was the basis for Terry Gilliam's 12 Monkeys. But it's only 28 minutes long, so it's a featurette, let's call it, and right. therefore technically not an overlooked feature film.
Right, and there's so many of these short films that lend themselves to science fiction and science fiction concepts that don't necessarily pan out into a two-hour story of three acts.
We just came up with another great top 10 idea. We've never done our top 10 all-time favorite short films.
Hey, that's a massive list.
See?
It?
That would be a great one, though. It'd be great yeah. because you're so well-versed historically in so many of the seminal short films, and I hate short films. So that combination is probably would come up with really, really good stuff.
Perfect. chucking together of everything. I love it.
Let's get started. What would be your 10th most overlooked science fiction film?
Well, I'm going to say, and again, was this overlooked? Because it did all right at the box office when it came out after the sequel to 2001 Space Odyssey. It's 2010, the year we made Contact by Arthur C. Clarke, directed by, had Roy Schneider in it. It had Sean Connery.
No, it did not have Sean Connery. It did not have Sean Connery. Let's stop lying about Sean Connery being in it whatsoever. Roy Scheider.
He's in every movie.
Bob Balaban. Maybe you're mistaking.
Bob Balaban.
Great
yes,
improv comic Bob Balaban for Sean Connery. Has Helen Mirren in it.
A young Helen Mirren,
John
yes.
Lithgow. But,
That's right.
Yeah, nary a Sean Connery to be found. And it was written and directed by Peter Hyams, whose movies do all tend to be overlooked. One of my favorites, which came close to this list today, Capricorn 1, is a Peter Hyams
right.
film that I think is
O.J. Simpson's big...
One of it. You remember my theory at the time that... the plot of we're talking about Capricorn 1 all of a sudden, but the plot of Capricorn yeah. 1 is that they faked the first Mars landing, and everyone said, oh, it's a thinly veiled metaphor for how they faked the moon landing, and that's why right. everyone in it would have their careers or their lives ruined within a matter of years. because they were all big stars at the time, and then nothing. And
right.
O.J. being the nothing. Most obvious example of how they got him, how they silenced
them. They got him.
Totally. But so Peter Hyams, he was making some interesting films back then, and I think a case could be made for it being overlooked. His films being overlooked, but see, I would say Capricorn 1 is more overlooked than 2010 because I don't know how there's anyone who knows of 2001 that doesn't know of 2010. I would say that this is a case, again, of being it underrated and overshadowed.
See, really? Because I know people who didn't know. Well, and I'm talking to people now who don't even know there's a 2001 Space Odyssey. So
yeah, but those
so
are,
perhaps I'm
but those people
with the
are just
people.
Stupid, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sometimes you got to thin the herd, Dean.
Right. Now, and this is the one you said, you told me the story that Arthur C. Clarke wrote this after. So he had the book, but then he saw the movie and rewrote the book.
No. 2001.
How did that work again?
2001, he wrote the book and the screenplay at the same time. So there are ways in which 2001, the book and screenplay, are incredibly similar, more similar than most book adaptations of screenplays. However, the book got published before the movie got finished because Kubrick takes his time. And by the time the film got finished, they had jettisoned the slingshot around Jupiter to make it to Saturn, where all of the third act of the book 2001 takes place.
Right.
So huge difference there. Now, that footage, much of that effects footage that they made would end up getting used in Silent Running by director Douglas Trumbull, who made those effect shots. But when Arthur C. Clarke set out to write the book as a sequel, 2010, he wrote it as a sequel to the movie, not as a sequel to his own book. So
And then when they cut it out, he had...
He removed all references to Saturn. But he does, finally, in 2010, the movie, get to use the slingshot around Jupiter. Because that's how they get home. But it is an underrated movie, I'll give you that. If it's overlooked, okay, then it's unfairly overlooked because it pissed people off because it tried to answer the mysteries of 2001, a movie that I think is about exploring symbolism. We've talked about this before. I don't think it's about what the symbols mean. I think it's about symbolism and the importance of exploring symbolism, that's what opens us to our evolution. And by trying to answer what that film meant, it really was seen as reducing 2001. But if, as a standalone story and space adventure, it's better than most 2001.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think that's why everybody overlooks it, because they go, well, it's no 2001.
Yeah.
Well, but if you forget those two in that movie exist. If you forget 2001 exists, 2010 is great.
Well, I made the same point, did I not, about the second X-Files movie, that if that did not have the brand The X-Files on it, it was a superior suspense picture.
Yeah, well, that's true. It might bring in the baggage.
Yeah, it might be bad X-Files, but that doesn't mean it's bad filmmaking. You know, and I'm not saying it is, bad X-Files, but we have done a two-part show on that. So, moving on, my number 10 of the most overlooked science fiction films of all time is the movie that inspired this whole damn thing. When Olav Phillips, our friend, one day was writing to me about this movie, and I thought to myself, how the hell does no one know about this movie? How is it that I haven't even seen this movie once, even though I knew about it, when it's directed by one of my all-time favorite directors, five favorite directors, Robert Altman, and this is 1979's Quintet, a post-apocalyptic sci-fi film that's not only directed by Altman, who, let's face it, in the 70s was as famous as movie directors got. I mean, maybe he wasn't George Lucas and Spielberg or Coppola, but he was right up there among the most famous filmmakers. And it stars no less than Paul Newman. Ever a more famous movie star than Paul Newman? Probably not. Yeah. And yet nobody knows about this movie.
I know. For you to overlook it means it's really overlooked. I know. After we talked about it, I tried to find a copy of this movie to watch. And it was really... I don't think I did, actually. I still haven't seen it.
So it's about, in this post-apocalyptic future, this icy, one can imagine.
The new ice ages, yeah.
Yeah, a nuclear winter, whatever the cause of it is, this hunter, this seal hunter, goes to one of the last remaining but dying out cities, and where a game is being played. Really a high-stakes wagering game for fun and profit, but you sometimes have to risk your life. And it's really just to give the players a sense that they are still alive. So there's some interesting metaphor there. But what the movie doesn't work, and it interestingly enough, when Altman came up with the story, he was developing it, the screenplay, for Walter Hill to direct.
Oh.
And when Walter Hill became unavailable, then Altman ended up directing it himself, or else the financing was going to fall through. But Altman is the wrong guy for it. His long takes and documentary kind of style approach are both the most interesting things about it, but also the reason that it doesn't work. Because there's no sense of life to this game or this, he's really much more interested in the lifelessness of it.
Right.
So...
That's interesting.
But, again, a huge failure by Altman and Paul Newman. How do we not know about this?
I know. And what year was that?
1979, yeah.
Good Lord. So you'd think that that would be... Well, I'm trying to think what else came out at that time. I guess it was just the turn from Jaws.
Well, no.
Blockbuster.
But people were looking for blockbuster sci-fi. We'll explore this a little bit more as the show goes on. What's your number nine most overlooked sci-fi film?
So we all know Star Wars, but George Lucas, his first feature film, that is a favorite of mine is THX 1138. And again, from people, maybe I'm just talking to stupid people. Nobody, this is overlooked. Nobody knows that this exists. Nobody knows. Everybody thinks he just sort of walked in and directed Star Wars one day, and that's all he's ever done. And so, THX 1138 is it's low budget, but it's a future world where, it's massively overcrowded. Everybody's living underground. The police are, chasing you based on their budget. And if they go over budget, they stop chasing you. There is a hologram that escapes, a prison that is just without walls, just a foreverness that in order to escape, you just have to walk for days on end. All these great concepts, all this fantastic ideas. I love this film. I watch it. I have my own signed DVD copy of it. That's how much I'm into this. And that's how much people don't know about it. THX 1138.
I think there was a time when people, if you'd mentioned it, they would have thought you were talking about the theater sound system, right? The THX theater sound system. And even then, they wouldn't have known about the movie, the Lucas movie. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The sound system is named after the...
After the movie. It's before... Yeah. It's before he even made American Graffiti, right? It's his first film out of film school. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And you could see, if you see his film school as USC, I think there's a grad project on YouTube somewhere that he did that they dug up. You can see a lot of the elements.
About us doing this show now is that I think there was a time this wasn't overlooked. And it might have been overlooked upon its initial release, but following American Graffiti and then especially Star Wars, there was a time when THX 1138 was hailed, when it was prized, when it had been revisited and rediscovered. Right? I remember that in the 80s. But now it has fallen into the overlooked again. And that's the thing, is that sometimes these films are rediscovered and then fall into becoming overlooked again.
That's funny.
Well, yeah. and we live in a time now where especially it's easy for films to become overlooked because every single movie ever made is at your disposal. And so if you haven't heard of it, how are you supposed to know to go looking for it? You don't. You just look for the films you've heard about. And that's how stuff becomes overlooked. There's no conspiracy involved. Knowledge just gets lost, my friends. Number nine for me on overlooked science fiction films. And I believe that although it's not truly an overlooked movie because of the international reputation of the director as science fiction, it is becoming more and more overlooked all the time, and I don't think it should be. And that is Melancholia, which made my top 10 list for 2011. Yeah. And it is a science fiction drama psychological thriller written and directed by Lars von Trier, starring Kirsten Dunst, Charlotte Gainsbourg, and Alexander Skarsgård. And it is a really, really interesting film. The story revolves around two sisters, one of whom is preparing to get married as a rogue planet is set to collide with Earth. And von Trier's inspiration came from a depressive episode he himself had suffered and the insight that he gleaned that depressed people have a tendency to remain quite calm, peaceful, and rational during catastrophic events. This might be one of the reasons that leads to our understanding of why Mayweather Lewis of Lewis and Clark was able to achieve all he did under just unimaginably brutal, challenging situations on that expedition. And yet he comes back to great acclaim, is made governor of the state, and immediately ventilates himself with a shotgun. And people want to believe that it's a conspiracy, but it also fits this idea of a depressive. That, yes, out in the wild, when he's challenged all the time to stay alive, he's the perfect guy to lead that expedition. Because he stays calm. He stays calm. But then once back in quote unquote ordinary reality, there's no taste, there's no color, there's no sensation, right? The depressive episode acts up. So anyway, so one sister is depressive, the other is getting married. A rogue planet is going to collide with Earth. It is the final hours and days. In these two sisters' relationships, we focus, it's a two-act structure, we focus on each sister during the two acts, and the metaphor of the two planets colliding, ending everything, is a metaphor for how these two sisters' worlds are colliding and ending all possibility of the life they had known prior to this collision. And it
that
is,
sounds good.
It is a fantastic, fantastic movie, and that's number nine, Melancholia. What's your number eight, Dean?
Well, there's this 2009 thing that not a lot of people talk about with Jared Leto and Sarah Pauly called Mr. Nobody.
I have never seen this. I have not, and that would tell you, although I know about it, it's probably overlooked.
Yeah, so this is set in the future when all of humanity has conquered mortality, and they get their molecules, their telemetries extended. Everybody except one guy, Jared Leto, who plays Nemo Nobody, and he's living to 118 years, and now everybody's fascinated by this guy who's growing old when nobody else does. And so they keep interviewing him and using hypnosis to recall his memories. And it's sort of, you know, it's non-linear. It was, you know, funded through European finances and stuff. And so, I don't think anybody thought it as a big, American movie, but I really like this. And I know a lot of people, didn't dig it, but could it be the non-narrative the non-linear narrative that screwed them over or what, but. This is a movie that needs looking at.
I'm going to offer this theory. And the first is the casting of Jared Leto. He could have had a career as, he could have been Zac Efron if he wanted to be.
Right.
And he didn't want to be. Right. He wanted to be an actor and he wanted to do interesting stuff. He is an artist. He's a musician. And I think what he had in terms of fans were turned off by his art house sensibility in terms of choosing roles. And I don't think the right people took him seriously, if I may. And it wasn't until he wins the Oscar for Dallas Buyers Club that I started hearing about Mr. Nobody. I then started hearing about that being championed, going, you know, guys, it shouldn't be such a surprise. Here's his work in this movie.
Right.
So I think that's why I started seeing it turn up in more places. It certainly got an increased visibility with his Oscar role. But I do think that it was, oddly enough, the casting of him that probably gets it financed, even though it's a low budget, like you said, independent international financing package. But it's probably his involvement that gets it financed. But it's also his involvement in that kind of film that prevents it from being embraced by a larger audience at that time. Anyway.
Yeah. Interesting.
If you release that movie right now, I think it would have a chance to do a lot better.
See, this is all about timing, isn't it? Everything's about timing.
It really is.
Yep.
All right. Number eight for me, a modest little cult hit at the time, but I fear that it has become overlooked and forgotten, and maybe in part because there was a in-name sequel, though it involved none of the original actors. That failed miserably, and that sometimes can really drag an original down with it. And that is The Hidden. Do you remember this movie, The Hidden?
Oh, yeah. 1987.
Give me a hint again. 1987, written by Bob Hunt under the pen name... I'm sorry. That is the pen name of writer, producer, director Jim Kauf. And it was directed by Jack Scholder. And it starred a pre-Twin Peaks Kyle MacLachlan.
Oh, yeah.
Who was trying to get a comeback. You know, he'd done this. He did Blue Velvet, I think, the same right around the same time. Trying to come back after the Dune fiasco.
Right.
And it starred Michael Noury. And it included supporting turns by Clue Gulager, Edo Ross...
Oh.
Chris Mulkey, and Claudia Christian, who spends much of her performance in the film naked as a jaybird.
Wow.
It's about basically a cop and a federal agent of some kind on the trail of a spree killer who keeps changing identities and bodies.
Ah.
It was a huge influence on Twin Peaks. Some have said that it's really clear that MacLachlan is even testing out Agent Cooper in this movie. And Chris Mulkey, who has a key supporting part in it, would then play a major recurring role in the TV series Twin Peaks. But it's also a big influence on The X-Files as well. And again, 1987, The Hidden... It's a hell of a lot of fun. It's too much fun, and especially given MacLachlan and Twin Peaks returning and The X-Files returning, it's too much fun to still be overlooked. People should check it out.
Excellent.
Number seven.
Awesome. Number seven for me is I was at a friend's place in Cleveland, and she said, "Hey, have you ever seen this dystopian science fiction thing? It's with Christian Bale." Post, you know, World War III, called Equilibrium. And I said, no, I've never seen it. And she put in the DVD, and my God, it was fantastic. I mean, not fantastic. It was really good. It's a future world where art and creativity is forbidden, and everybody has to take a Prozac-like drug called Prozium to suppress all emotion and encourage obedience. And, you know, there's some really great ideas. The art direction was fantastic. It looked great. Emily Watson's in it. Taye Diggs, Christian Bale as the totalitarian. But then it seemed like somebody came in there and added a lot of crazy action, martial arts.
Oh, too bad. Too bad.
Yeah.
Because I have heard about this every so often. People will rave about this to me, and I do come back to the point of how have I not seen this, and how does nobody know of this? These are Christian Bale, huge name even at that time, and it seems relevant, right? I don't scratch my head when films like that fail, because again, timing is everything, and maybe it's not something that there's an appetite for at that, but how do we not know about it? How, you know,
like
how,
yeah,
Tom Hanks said that the modern definition of a movie star is if the movie is successful, you know about it. If it's unsuccessful, you know about it because they report on it being a failure. Whoa, Tom Hanks, right. Big failure, right? And I think that that's right. A really apt thing. We tend to hear about failures. So when there's a movie that, even though it's a failure, that doesn't explain to me why it's overlooked.
Right.
You know,
and again, it's not, it's that, you know, when they start the overthrow of the regime using martial arts, it takes a different tact than the thoughtful exploration of a society without emotion and obedience, you know? So your revolution comes from just sheer fighting. Whereas, you know, you would hope that creativity or an underground art movement or something that it seemed to be leading towards would have been the solution.
I wonder if there were multiple cooks in the kitchen and fighting over it led to it getting buried upon its release. You know, I don't know,
yeah.
But that has happened before.
Yeah, and it feels like that, you know, a lot of times you can sort of, like, once you're in film production, you can see how other producers struggle to get stuff to the screen. So,
I think gets overlooked way too much in our modern film age is one of the real pioneers of the American independent movement, and that's John Sayles, right?
Right.
He had a movie that I don't was marginally successful, called Return of the Secaucus 7, but it would never become overlooked as long as there was an unofficial remake/ripoff called The Big Chill. Like he said, no, that movie has ensured that my movie will play in repertory for 20 years on a double bill with it, so no one will ever forget Return of the Secaucus 7. But he made a science fiction film that was quite hailed at the time called The Brother from Another Planet in 1984.
Oh, yeah.
Written, directed, and edited by John Sayles, starring Joe Morton. It was my introduction to Joe Morton, who's an actor who has achieved a great deal. You know, maybe most famous for playing the guy that invents Skynet in Terminator 2, right?
right.
But Brother from Another Planet is about an alien who is an escaped slave who, while fleeing, quote, another planet, as it's called, has crash-landed and hides out in Harlem. It came out the same year as Starman, which has a certain similarity in plot, again. But Brother from Another Planet, I saw that in film school, and I fell in love with it at that time because here's another wonderful example of science fiction getting to bring in lots of different genres because it's funny. It's a funny character comedy. It's a perfect fish out of water story, like what Starman got hailed for. But it also is so relevant to race and class relations.
Of course.
And I don't think that should make it any less relevant today of all times, actually. But sadly, I think a lot of John Sayles' works are overlooked in this day and age, and it's too bad because he really was one of the true modern independent film pioneers. I think that brings us to your number 6, Dean Haglund.
My number 6 is 1999 David Cronenberg's video game sci-fi horror film called Existence, spelled with a Z at the end there. Z because he's Canadian. This is Jennifer Jason Leigh and Jude Law as game designers in a future world where you don't have Xboxes. You're plugged in through bioports in your spine to virtual reality games that you go in into the world. It's more relevant now, I think. I think it had trouble back in when it came out, because it was like everyone said it was like Videodrome, and it's just how humans, you know, interact with technologies and stuff like that. So they didn't think it was like everybody said, oh, Cronenberg's just copying himself. But I think it's actually pretty good if you watch it. I mean, it's pretty fascinating. some great cameos. Willem Dafoe as the black marketer installer of bioports, and Callum Keith Rennie as the game store owner. Like some great acting, and I think this is
if
really
it's
like
Canadian, if it's Canadian and sci-fi, Callum Keith Rennie can't be far behind.
That's true. That guy's in everything. Existence. Have you ever seen this?
Yes, I have, and I actually thought about this, including it on my list, and I couldn't actually recall whether I thought it deserved to be remembered. That was the thing. But I do have a theory about hopefully I'm remembering this correctly, but there was another science fiction film that came out at almost the exact same time, maybe even that week. And I believe it was Open Your Eyes, the Spanish film that would later get remade as Vanilla Sky with Tom Cruise. But the Spanish film that introduced the world, among others, to Penelope Cruz. And it is Alejandro Amenábar who would then make The Others, starring Nicole Kidman. It really launched him to international prominence. And it thematically, it's a science fiction film, Open Your Eyes, and it thematically covers very similar terrain. Now, obviously, it's foreign language, so it's never going to cut into the box office that much. But I recall that what would you call it? Not the image makers, but kind of the trendsetters and the people that decide what's what in the world of genre film at that time, all basically, for the misfortune of existence, compared the two and said, but this is the one that's really worth seeing. And so they championed one over the other, if I remember correctly. And
damn it.
And so that's possibly why, because you do need to have kind of the culture shapers behind you when you're doing some, genre work that is outside the mainstream. Even if it has big names, you're still going to need the right, opinion makers behind you.
Huh. Isn't that funny? So, again, here's another movie overlooked because of distribution timing.
Well, and
we're
also, let's
developing
face it,
a theme.
Let's face it. I think cyberpunk, which I would include Existence in, which in the late 90s, there were several of these efforts. Johnny Mnemonic comes to mind.
Johnny Mnemonic, absolutely.
It seemed like a great idea, and I think the marketplace proved there was no interest in those. So even though it was prescient and ahead of the curve, I would like to see people try cyberpunk now. Honestly, I think it might be much more accepted. But my number six is, speaking of foreign language sci-fi, hails from Argentina. It was a 1986 Argentine science fiction drama called Man Facing Southeast. And this got a theatrical release when I was in college. I remember seeing an ad in the paper, and that's what led me to go to theaters to see an Argentine science fiction film. It would be nominated or submitted for the as Best Foreign Language for the 60th Academy Awards, but was not nominated for Best Foreign Language Film. It's a really, really interesting film. I am going to tell you just basically, Dean, the plot, and I want you to tell me whether this plot's familiar.
Okay.
The staff and patients at Buenos Aires's Jose Borda Psychiatric Hospital are going about their daily business on a summer day, 1986.
Right.
Staff psychiatrist is surprised to hear that his ward for nonviolent delusional cases has one patient too many when they did the head count that morning. The doctor finds the patient in the chapel playing the organ like a virtuoso. So the doctor summons him to his office, and the doctor finds that the man's speech is measured and articulate, and he explains his presence on Earth as a result of his image being projected from light years away.
Hmm.
So there's a movie that I and others who have seen Man Facing Southeast would describe as an illegal ripoff of that movie.
Right.
Called K-Pax, starring Kevin Spacey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, which came first?
Well, this, Kevin, K-Pax was 2001, I think. And this was 1986. So 15 years later, without paying to remake it, they just ripped the damn thing off. And
good Lord.
I think that the reason that Man Facing Southeast is so overlooked is because that remake was so shitty. If that ripoff slash remake, look, they ripped it off, fine. But if the remake had been a hit, there would have been a lot of people saying, fuck that movie. It ripped off an even better movie. And you would have heard about it as a result. But Man Facing Southeast, everything K-Pax wanted to be, but wasn't.
Yeah.
That's my number six.
Oh.
What's your...
Fantastic.
What's your number five?
My number five... this I saw at Sundance when I was there in 2004. In fact, the only film I saw because a lot of partying. Anyway, the point is that, you know, me and sci-fi and time travel being my bugaboo. This is a little time travel independent sci-fi drama called Primer. From 2004.
I know this movie. Yes.
You know this to David, Shane Carruth. Directed and written. He's an ex-engineer, so he didn't try dumb it down. In fact, it was really complicated. And it seemed like one of the few time travel movies that you go, that could be workable. Like, all the plot holes were sort of filled by actual science sounding, with, you know, temporal anomalies Field A activates time B and sort of thing. It was, I really thought this was good. And when it won the grand jury prize in 2004, I thought, well, it's going to get a big release. Everybody's going to love this thing. And that was the last I heard of it.
Yeah, it did not get a big release and people did not love it. And his later movies, he's brilliant. And they are very thoughtful and they're very well done. And I would say in watching his movies that he makes some of the most confusing science lectures I took come to life and make sense for me. As a movie... I don't really have fun watching them, and I'm not exactly Mr. Fun. And if I find myself going, couldn't it be fun? You know that there's no chance for this movie.
Well, yeah, because, I mean,
if I'm falling on that side, if I'm the guy going, can it be fun? It's going to be... But I think our fives are interestingly linked because my number five, every bit as much a science lecture being embodied by a troupe of actors explaining the theory of coherence for your enjoyment, not the accomplished work that Primer was, not the accomplished filmmaker, and yet fun. Coherence, which we've talked about before, is a science fiction film and a mystery directed by James Ward Burkett in his directorial debut. Stars Emily Faldoni as a woman who must deal with strange occurrences following a comet sighting at a dinner party. The film focuses on eight people at that dinner party. And during that party, the comet passes over them. And this causes the house and the occupants to intertwine with multiple such houses and occupants from other realities. There is a dark zone between all those realities. And when one of the characters passes through the dark zone, they leave their reality and enter another reality at random. The one person that we follow the whole movie constantly is Emily. She's listed in the credits as Emily Prime as a result. So what that means is all the other actors are basically changing characters when we see them because they are them from different universes all of which are having that dinner party at the same time, however.
Right, right. So this is the ideal of parallel universes explaining temporal, quantum, linear time, right?
You
so
once time used, is a... you once used this movie to help explain to me Schrodinger's cat. So this movie would make Schrodinger's cat purr. Anyway, it also stars my friend Hugo Armstrong as good an actor in Los Angeles as there is. You loved him in the Waiting for Godot at the Amundsen, I think.
That's right.
So
there you go.
What is your number four, Dean Haglund?
Well, I went on to my old Netflix thinking, hey, you know what? I bet foreign Netflix selling movies that are overlooked would be a great way to find overlooked sci-fi films. And sure enough, there was one that I hadn't heard about. But then I realized I had heard slightly, maybe a little bit about it. But it was starring Jake Gyllenhaal and Vera Farmiga and Jeffrey Wright. And this thing is called Source Code. And it's a story, get it, believe it or not, about quantum mechanics, using quantum mechanics and to drop somebody in 8 minutes before they die based on the electrical field of their memory, and using that to then determine how a bomb went off on a Chicago commuter train. So it's... at first, if you read it as a plot line, it's difficult to understand, but they actually do a great job in plausible quantum mechanics. It's not time travel, it's time sequencing, as they make very clear in the movie. And so once you get past that, I really like this movie. And I think it was just overlooked strictly because the marketing just said, a guy relives, you know, the same 8 minutes over and over again to save the world.
I'm
so,
going to argue with you that it was overlooked because it was bad. That's what I'm going to overlook. Yeah. And because it got a huge release. Because just because that concept is well worked out doesn't make his character interesting to follow.
Right.
They do the hard stuff well, but the easy stuff, which actually is the hard stuff, they don't do well, which is character and story coming
True.
Out of character. And
yeah.
Even Jeffrey Wright comes as close to being uninteresting as I've ever seen him.
Which is saying a lot.
Yeah.
But again, I think because everybody was so focused on getting the science right,
yeah,
that they forgot to do character. But again, if you like your movie to have
if you like boring movies, then by all means, watch a half hour science fiction lecture, stretched out over two.
Okay, well, there you go. Source Code, mine. Out
I love
the window.
That. What's great about this top 10 is that we haven't at all picked any of the same, which would argue that these are overlooked. By the way,
right? Because neither. Yeah, both lists are obscure.
Yeah,
and or
I mean, and we've talked about them before. Many of them. Yeah. I mean, I reviewed Source Code on the show, for crying out loud. So
that's right.
We've talked about these before, and yet, so, you know, it is, I like to think we're doing a good job, and I like to think people aren't at home going, nope, know that one, know that one, know all of these, I know all of these, these aren't overlooked at all. Who sounds
these
like
aren't
that?
Overlooked.
I don't know, but, all right.
That's terrible.
My number four is another independent film. From 2011, and that also is something I love, is how many of these sci-fi movies we're talking about are indie sci-fi movies, right?
Right.
The whole indie sci-fi world is one rich...
A big deal.
...with really good work, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
In 2011, there was a movie called Another Earth from director Mike Cahill that stars Britt Marling, who wrote it with Cahill. It also stars William Mapother... and Robin Lord Taylor. And it was another Sundance premiere. The storyline involves a young woman played by Britt Marling who is driving along, and she hears a news report that scientists have spotted, surprisingly close to Earth, another Earth-like planet that appears to be almost identical to Earth. And while right. hearing this news report, she cranes her head out the window while driving to see if she can see it, because they say in the light at a certain direction, you can faintly make it out with the naked eye. It seems like a star, right? So she does this and crashes into some people and kills a woman and a child. And and the man driving the car is in a coma. So it's an accident, but he's in a coma. And when he comes out of the coma, the woman goes to apologize, to introduce herself and to apologize and to try to make amends. And she chickens out, and he claims to be someone who was sent to do his house cleaning for him as he recovers. So she goes to work for him, cooking and cleaning for the man whose life she ruined. Meanwhile, the Earth, this other Earth, has been getting closer and indeed is identical in all ways to our Earth, except from the moment these two Earths discovered each other. From that moment on, everything started to develop differently on that world. So there is the possibility on that world that this man's family is alive. So this this world offers possibilities for that man, also for this girl to get away from this reality. And indeed, the first flights to that world are being planned. I will say no more, but this is the basic storyline behind Another Earth. Really nice acting performances, but really such a cool storyline.
Yeah, that is a cool one. I got to see that.
So what is your what is your number three?
My number three is my niece, who's a huge David Bowie fan, wearing the T-shirts and everything, had no idea he was in a science fiction movie in the 60s called The Man Who Fell to Earth. This is a haunting story of David Bowie playing an alien, if I'm not mistaken, who then... as people start probing him, they start bugging him. But it's a commentary on society at the time, as seen through the eyes of an alien who's very, David Bowie plays him almost ethereal, like so gentle. And then, of course, his contact lenses get laser stuck to his eyes. You know, there's a lot to this movie. And I loved it. And I know so many people who've never even heard of it. So The Man Who Fell to Earth.
I can't believe that this is overlooked, that this could be considered overlooked. I can't. First of all, in the 1960s, the book was a huge, huge hit. In 1976, when the movie comes out, it's a huge, huge hit. Bowie, a big star, and Nicholas Rogue, a major director. And Bowie died last year. I don't know if you read about that. Unless that's overlooked, I don't believe that this movie is overlooked, because this movie played everywhere again after his death.
Then how is it that my niece has never heard of it?
Your niece doesn't know about it? What the kids don't know, you need you need a black hole the size of this galaxy in order to contain what the kids don't know. The Man Who Fell to Earth is not overlooked. You know what the problem is, Dean Haglund, is...
what's that?
Kids don't give a shit about movies.
Is that what it is?
They don't like movies. Now... And you know what else I heard? They don't like rock and roll either.
Oh. So we're now fans of an archaic art form.
Yeah, we're dinosaurs, man. All right.
Lord.
So number Never three, before. Man Who Fell to Earth. But I didn't know you loved this movie, but that's interesting.
I did love it, yeah. Okay.
All right.
Well, I'm sorry. Okay.
No.
Never mind.
Fine. Okay. My number three At least you picked a great one after Source Code. All right, my number three.
I got some other shitty ones here.
My number three is from 1982, American film directed by Aaron Lipstadt and starring Don Keith Opper and Klaus Kinski, and it's called Android. Do you remember this?
Oh, yeah, barely.
It follows the story of a scientist, a mad scientist, who's better than Klaus Kinski, and his assistant, who are working on an illegal android program from their lab on a space station, which orbits the Earth. And it was awarded a whole lot of Best Science Fiction Film Awards, you know, by the various... organizations that, you know, reward such genre work back in 83. But it received fairly lukewarm, at best, reviews from critics in this country. In Europe, it was very hailed. And science fiction filmmakers here liked it. No less than George Lucas hailed it as smart and relevant. But, you know, I'm not sure in the year when the big science fiction hit was Return of the Jedi, people gave a shit about anything being smart or relevant. Give us give us Ewoks, they demanded. But I've always been surprised that, you know, you got a crazy, you know, it's a mad scientist, monster, sexual, psychological science fiction thriller on a space station. How can this go... overlooked for so long. I don't know.
With Klaus Kinski.
I wish that it had done better because it would have been interesting to see what other movies, especially in sci-fi, the director might have been able to go do. Instead, he made quite a career for himself as a television director, but he did, in science fiction, make a little bit of a mark with some of the most interesting episodes of that sci-fi series, The 4400. Which was definitely a show with some merits to it. So that's my number three, Android. What's your number two, Dean?
Number two, we love our 70s Russian sci-fi art films, don't we? And what better than co-written and directed by Andrei Tarkovsky? It's Solaris.
Oh!
Haunting...
Solaris. Totally. I thought for sure you were going to go in the other direction. You were going to do Stalker, which we saw together. Solaris.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Solaris. Stalker was great. And that was on my list, too. Can you count that as sci-fi? I guess it's post-apocalyptic, but it was more, Stalker's sci-fi. Stalker's considered sci-fi.
Yeah. But
Solaris.
So you think Solaris is overlooked, huh? Even with the big remake by
especially
Soderbergh.
Because of the big remake, yeah, that no one actually knows that that's a remake. Anytime you say Solaris, you go, oh, that thing with Clooney that Soderbergh did.
So you think that this is what I was describing earlier about how sometimes a bad sequel can bring something down. A bad remake might bring it down too.
Exactly, and wipe it off the face of everyone's must-see list. So, it's such a great science fiction film, often cited as the greatest of science fiction films in the history of cinema, nominated for the Palme d'Or. I mean,
it's 1A. It's definitely 1A. If 1 is 2001, then 1A is Solaris. And I swear to God, I used to go see it every 3 months at the New Beverly Cinema in a double feature with La Jetée.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, that is a good double
It's film. A great one. So it's about if Fellini, I mean, it's Fellini-esque at times, but it's almost like that science fiction movie that Fellini's pretending to be making in 8.5.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. This is the movie that came out of that. Post-pre-production hotel stay.
This planet that they are exploring is a planet that's intuitively connecting with the unconscious of the people exploring it.
Right.
How ahead of its time is that concept? right? We're now talking about this idea of conscious co-creation, right? And manifestation and the zero point field and all the Institute of Noetic Science, all this stuff. In the early 1970s, Tarkovsky is so on top of this.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Kind of amazing. Yeah.
It's great. Yeah.
Okay. My number two could not be more different, except that it is also a foreign language film. And it is from 2015. Right. And I think that this is overlooked so far, so much so that nobody's ever even described it as science fiction. And it was nominated for Best Foreign Language Film at the 88th Academy Awards. It's called Embrace of the Serpent, directed by Ciro Guerra, shot in black and white. The film tells two stories 30 years apart, featuring Karamakate, an Amazonian shaman and the last survivor of his tribe. And he travels with two scientists, first with a German, Theo von Martius, in 1909, and then 3 decades later with an American named Evan in 1940, who both, for different reasons, are looking for the rare Yakruna, sacred plant. And this movie is every bit as much science fiction in its own way as 2001 A Space Odyssey. And 2001 A Space Odyssey in its own way is every bit as much anthropological and archaeological exploration as this movie is. They're both interested in concepts of the evolution of man and what it takes to evolve man, what it might take to evolve man. And like 2001 Space Odyssey, it uses a science fiction premise because this sacred plant, the Yakruna, is completely a scientific manufacturing on the part of the writer director. All its properties and everything are completely made up. And so its explanation of history is dependent entirely on a science fiction construct.
Look at that.
And if that's not enough to make
Embrace
you think it's science fiction, the ending of the movie is right out of the Stargate at the end of 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Wow.
It's really cool.
So there you go.
Yeah. It
that is definitely overlooked.
It goes from black and white to color, and it had me sit up in my house and go, whoa, at the end. So that's my number two. What's your number one most overlooked science fiction film?
Okay, so, well, is it a tie? Okay, so we're down to what technically you said now a couple of my overlooked aren't overlooked at all. They're massive hits, and everybody's seen them.
No,
so,
not massive hits, but I would say they're not necessarily overlooked. Okay, go ahead.
But I guess I'm talking to the wrong people, because when I go, hey, what about this movie? They go, what? Never heard
Perception
of it.
Perception is truth, Dean. Perception is truth.
Perception is truth. And so it down under here, the perception seems that Children of Men, no one's heard about.
Interesting.
This, our favorite sci-fi film of a post-apocalyptic world where no one can no longer give birth except for one person, and your man crush Clive Owen turns out to be the hero to get this one baby out from the revolution that's taking place between the revolutionaries and the oppressive government in this future world is amazing. Often for its camera work, a long, seemingly 15, 20 minute takes of elaborate choreography in a world that's art directed and, you know, and quite plausible. We've talked at length of this movie, and yet I think it's now overlooked, Children of Men.
I thought about including that.
You did?
I think maybe it's becoming overlooked. But here's the good news. I don't think it ever can become forgotten. Not only because it's great and because it was a decent enough hit, but because its director won't be forgotten, right? I mean, he does Harry Potter. He does Gravity, right? So
yes.
So people are going to, for lack of a better term, gravitate towards his films, and they will always discover Children of Men. And if you thought some of those seeming master shots in Gravity were impressive, check out Children of Men.
Yeah, for sure.
So finally, my number one, as a whole lot of metal is being ground down to fine dust in the background at your place.
All those movies, I had them.
It actually sounds like the titular train in my number one being ground to a halt outside your place. That train is Snowpiercer.
Oh yeah,
and my
I thought you hated this one.
What do you mean? This was my number one film of that year. This was the
was
my
it?
Number one film of the year it came out. Yeah. And yeah. It's a consensus top 10 for the year that it came out. And it is a English language Czech Korean science fiction thriller based on a graphic novel. It's from the acclaimed director Bong Joon-ho, his first English language film. 80% of the movies in English. A huge box office stars. Like Chris Evans, Captain America stars in it. A lot of wonderful character actors like Tilda Swinton and Jamie Bell and Octavia Spencer and John Hurt and Ed Harris. The movie takes place aboard the globe-spanning Snowpiercer train, which holds the last remnants of humanity after an attempt at climate engineering in order to stop global warming has unintentionally created a new ice age. And it's a fantastic action film about big ideas, not only ecological ideas, but ideas of individual versus humanity, you know, versus society and education and so many things. And I would liken it to being our contemporary Blade Runner, Dean. It's it's got a huge box office star. It's got an international cast. It's got an acclaimed visionary director, tons of action and suspense, and a whole bunch of bizarre, amusing character turns. It's got a unique, groundbreaking look, and yet no domestic box office whatsoever. Even though... Unlike Blade Runner, it was a huge success with critics. Blade Runner was panned by most critics, not in L.A., but everywhere else. But this film was a consensus top 10 for the year. And yet, no one in America even knows this goddamn thing exists. A bigger hit elsewhere in the world, but no one here does. And the big theory for it, of course, is that the Weinsteins got into a pissing match with the filmmaker. And so they buried the thing by releasing it video on demand at the same time that they opened it into a handful of theaters. And that's all she wrote. At a time when every movie ever made is available at your disposal, how do you know about these movies if you don't hear about these movies?
Exactly. Then we get to marketing.
So maybe we're helping to make sure that although... almost all of the films we talked about are overlooked. they will never be forgotten because your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour will continue to be shining a light on them in the post-apocalyptic cinematic darkness. Well,
when we're just enjoying archaic art forms similar to harpsichord operas.
Well, quite on, and podcasting. Maybe that's another one. I don't know.
There you go.
All right.
I don't know.
That brings us to the end of our next to last top 10 show of year 10 of Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. We'll be back with a new show next week where we talk about all manner of things before our 10th anniversary show in a fortnight from now. Until next week, I'm Phil Lairness.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.